The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The UN Food Agency said on Friday that world food prices jumped nearly 13% in March to a new record high.
A CNBC poll reveals 81% of adults say they think the economy is likely to experience a recession this year.
26 million people confined to their homes and no end in sight. The full lockdown, which started in parts of China's largest city 10 days ago, has been extended.
The United Nations tonight with an historic move, voting to suspend Russia from the UN Human Rights Council. This after the horrors revealed in Bucha and other Ukrainian towns after the Russians left.
Shell does not set or control the price of crude oil.
U.S. oil executives were on the defensive on Wednesday, fending off charges of price gouging leveled by lawmakers in a hearing on Capitol Hill.
Oil and gas companies report record high profits, and while American families are forced to pay record high prices at the pump.
Virginia Republican Morgan Griffith said recent White House efforts to boost production in the face of high prices were insufficient.
A temporary green light to produce oil from the Biden administration will not undo the damage and the layers of red tape and aggressive anti-fossil fuel policies driving gas prices to new highs.
Democrats such as Joe Pallone of New Jersey pressed the energy executives to do more for American consumers.
Bottom line is you set the wholesale price, and that's the biggest part of the retail price. So don't tell us that you can't do anything about it. You can do something about it.
But Shell USA President Gretchen Watkins pushed back.
Shell does not set or control the price that consumers pay. Indeed, it would be illegal for Shell to do so because nearly all Shell-branded retail stations in the U.S. are owned by independent operators who set their own prices in the marketplace.
The executives detailed their plans to increase production. Darren Woods, the chairman and chief executive of Exxon, the top U.S. oil company, told lawmakers his firm was in no way seeking to profit off Americans' pain.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, another week of losses for the major indexes, with the Dow adding a small gain for the week. Bond yields, meanwhile, continued to rise, with the yield on 10-year Treasury notes climbing to 2.7%. That's the highest yield we've seen on notes since going back to 2019. It's been a bad year for investors, with losses for both bonds and stocks as inflation heats up and commodity prices continue to march higher. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck, Frank Barbera joins me. Frank is still in the bunker and feels that stock prices have further downside ahead. Owen Tracy from Fuller Money will join me later on in the program. He feels the Fed is going to have a hard time raising interest rates, given the weakness in the economy and the burgeoning debt levels at all levels in the U.S., whether it's corporate, consumer, or government. Later on, we're going to have an extended big picture as I discuss why I believe oil prices are heading to $150 and why we're entering a decade of high inflation. It's not transitory. You won't want to miss this discussion. But first, let's find out the stories moving the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
The catalysts in the U.S. financial markets continue to be the Federal Reserve Bank's plans to aggressively return to normalcy from their overly accommodative position for the past 2 years in the face of ongoing inflationary pressure. The other message we see, given how stocks have traded over the past 2 weeks, is this rotation out of growth and into value stocks, out of cyclical and into defensive, non-cyclical stocks. We saw that message loud and clear last week, and the message continued into this week. To sum up the week's performance, the S&P 500 closed down 1.25%, the Dow Jones Industrial closed down 0.28%, and the NASDAQ closed down about 3.9%. In the S&P 500 sectors, 5 closed higher while 6 fell. Healthcare closed up almost 3.5%, energy up 3.2% despite the drop in oil, and consumer staples rose 2.7%. And again, the utilities closed up 1.9%, most of which are defensive areas. Technology was down 3.8%, discretionary was down 3.1%, and industrials were down 1.7%. Those were the worst three. Let's talk about the Fed. You know, this week on Tuesday, Fed Governor Brainard an FOMC voter, said she expects the Fed's balance sheet to shrink considerably more rapidly than in previous recoveries, starting as early as May. And we knew from previous months that Fed officials have wanted to allow Treasury bonds to mature and fall off its balance sheet soon after the first hike. But these were the first comments about the pace of the falloff. In true inflationary fashion, the 2-year Treasury yield rose 9 basis points to 2.5%, while the 10-year yield rose 14 points to 2.55%. This sent growth stocks barreling down as the S&P 500 technology sector finished down 2.2% Tuesday and consumer discretion fell 2.4%. Another contributing factor to the inflationary feelings was the ISM services report. While it was up and recovering from the COVID-related slowdown we saw in February, the prices paid index hit 83.8%, which was the second highest reading ever. Additionally, Kansas City Fed President George, another FOMC voter, told Bloomberg that a 50 basis point hike is an option next month. Fast forward one day to Wednesday, and the same trends in rates and stocks continued with weakness in growth, a rise in rates, and a rotation into value. The Fed minutes for March were released on Wednesday, and though investors responded both positively and negatively post the announcement, stocks ended the day down 1% for the S&P 500. That's because the minutes confirmed sentiment coming from Brainard and George that it would be appropriate to reduce the balance sheet by $95 billion per month, and that one or two 50 basis point hikes could be appropriate at future meetings. We've been hearing a lot of rhetoric for a few weeks now, but here it is in writing, talk of front-loading the next couple of Fed fund hikes. The news this week has led to concerns the Fed will break the economy to rein in inflation, which is what a flat and partially inverted yield curve is communicating. As such, growth stocks were the hardest hit while money rotated into defensive areas. In other news, Elon Musk disclosed a 9.2% stake in Twitter, gained a board seat this week, and changed his status to an active shareholder. The announcement initially led to a big rally in growth stocks on Monday before succumbing to inflation and weaker economic concerns later in the week. JetBlue Airways made a cash offer of $3.6 billion for Spirit Airlines, which had already agreed to a merger with Frontier Group. That's it for this week's wrap-up. Up next is Frank Barbera on the technical review of the markets.
Military defeat traditionally has been the cause of revolts in Russia. So if Russia suffers a defeat and its economy collapses, Putin could be overthrown. It is very possible indeed. And that's something that a lot of observers are concerned about because Russia is a nuclear power. What would happen in that instant?
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, stocks seem to be in another downtrend. The real question is, has this been a bear market rally and is there further damage ahead? Well, let's find out. We're going to go and see if we can find Frank. And Frank, last time you were down in the bunker. Frank, are you down there?
I am deep in the bunker. I've got my generator, right, and my food rations, Jim.
Okay, on a serious note, Frank, we've got the S&P on the day you and I are speaking. It looks like it's just holding at the 50-day moving average. We've got gold prices holding above their moving averages. Oil is dipping. So let's begin with stocks. What's your take on the S&P here? Was what we've seen here over the last month or so a bear market rally, and do we have further more to go on the downside?
In my opinion, Jim, I would say uncategorically, it looks like a bear market rally. I think there's, if you were putting probabilities on it, I'd say 75% chance this was a bear market rally. A very small percentage chance the rest that it, you know, it could be a final exhaustion rally that would lead to a double top in the S&P or maybe a token new high. But to be really honest, with the break over the last 2 to 3 days in the stock market, and we've seen NASDAQ moving down pretty substantially here over the last 3 days, I would say that really tilts to skew that the whole thing was a bear market rally. In Elliott terms, it's what's called an ABC irregular flat. And we just peaked out the upward C wave of that move, which is a counter trend. It's a counter trend pattern. And it's telling us that this could be a very, very important reversal that's starting to develop on the downside. The fact that we've held a sustained oversold reading now for a couple of days on the NASDAQ, the quality, well, there will be a bounce. And the NASDAQ is probably set up here. It's about 13,769. I think the support is going to come in around 13,640. It will probably see a weak bounce back towards about 14,165 over maybe 1 to 2 weeks. I think that rally back to 14,165 is going to get overbought very quickly. And if that happens and we turn down, that would then, in the process of a subsequent downside reversal, that would be the signal for a bear move. What's interesting about this is there are a lot of parallels to 1987. In 1987, there was a strong opening decline off the all-time highs in August, early September. And then there was an ABC irregular flat, a B wave counter trend rally that then kicked off. When it rolled over, it rolled right into the crash of 1987. So this is a bigger pattern, but it's the same wave structure. It's the same price structure that seems to be taking place within the market. And so in my opinion, this is a very high risk situation. That's why, you know, joking around a little bit, you know, we're having some fun with the bunker because, you know, I think this is that moment in time where the Fed policy is tightening up. You've got this tightening of credit that's coming where they have to raise interest rates, probably, as Ms. Brainard said the other day, at a faster pace than most expect. And basically under the old Marty Zweig rules, don't fight the Fed, don't fight the tape. Right now, you've got both of those in the process of turning negative. And the NASDAQ, I think, is the poster child for onsetting weakness. So that's how I would look at this right now.
I want to move to something that is really spooking the market, and this is reflecting what they think the Fed's going to do, Frank, and that's what's happening to Treasury yields. I'm looking right now. You've got the 7-year above the 10 and the 30-year. You've got the 5-year above the 10-year, and we have seen a big jump in 10-year yields now. We're looking at almost 2.7%. Mortgage rates are just a tad below 5, and so this has got to be trouble for the markets ahead, and I think this is one of the reasons why the NASDAQ is struggling.
I couldn't agree with you more. And the 10-year and 30-year spread, they're almost about to invert. So that tells me, you know, you've seen these yield curve inversions. And yes, yield curve inversions are a warning sign of an approaching slowdown or recession. They can be early. They can be as much as a year early. So it's not necessarily you know, a sign of, well, here the yield curve inverted for a couple of days and boom, you're going to be in a recession. No, but it is a reliable indicator that there's a slowdown ahead. And to me, that makes a lot of sense. I also see the same analogy in yields that we had in 1987. Back then, yields were moving up in an accelerating uptrend. And the 10-year was spiking, and that's what's happening again today. Both the 10-year and 30-year look like they're well-positioned for a run at 3%. in my opinion, that 3% handle on those long duration bonds, that could be an important trigger. That's a day that's crossing that threshold. If we cross that threshold in the weeks ahead, I think that could be the trigger for a really big sell-off in the stock market, maybe some kind of downside cascade. So I would be very careful right now. This is just that spot in the cycle where it's delicate. What happened in 87, of course, just to refresh everyone's memory, was the dollar was hitting new lows at the time. It was forcing up long-term interest rates. Inflation was running wild. And when the Feds finally started getting tightened, the market accelerated down into the big crash. This time, the dollar is strong, but you also have yields moving up. You have this spread between short-term rates and inflation is far wider. I mean, the Fed has never been this far behind the ball game in terms of hiking rates with in the face of really strongly accelerating inflation. So I think there's a dangerous dynamic. And what happened then was when in 87, when the market collapsed, yields also collapsed abruptly. So I think that the bond market, if you look at something like the TLT ETF, it's about 126 right now. That looks like it could trade down to 110, 115 over the next few weeks, where the bonds would just be effectively bludgeoned and yields would be over 3%. But I think if yields cross 3%, that's going to hurt the stock market. And then the bond market will rally on a safety, you know, on a safety trade as equities start to fall. So it's just a good time for the audience. This is the point to go slow. And also to be rewarded down the line, because if we do roll over into a bear move down, equities will get a heck of a lot cheaper. And you know what? They're going to rebound smartly off a bear market low in the months ahead, because the inflation and what we're seeing in the world is a lot of structural change. And we're really moving into a longer term up cycle of inflation. I think we're in the process of making that turn, and equities will be a very good place to be in the years ahead. So I'm bearish and cautious near term. I think there's downside risk, but I also think that just a little bit down the road, we're going to have ourselves one heck of a wonderful buying opportunity for stocks, and especially inflation hedge stocks, things like water, timber, gold, silver, you know, all fertilizer, energy, especially energy and precious metals. Draw a double underscore over both of those categories. This is going to be the kind of thing that can make people an awful lot of money and be very rewarding over the next few years. But we've got a little hitch in the get along right now.
Frank, the thing that I'm really concerned about is the Fed does not have a good track record of bringing in a soft landing. Last time they did that was 1994, when they doubled the Fed funds rate from 3 to 6. You take a look at the massive, and I mean massive amount of debt, either at the government level, the corporate level, the individual level. The Wall Street Journal reported consumers added $1 trillion of debt last year. So how do they navigate that, number one? Secondly, with ESG, lack of investment, and all the other things against the energy sector, including trying to get financing, I see oil prices heading higher. So there's another inflation factor. And then to make matters worse, the Democrats are going to try to resurrect Build Back Better with a massive, and I mean massive, spending program, along with $2.5 trillion in new taxes. So if you add rising interest rates, the Fed cutting back on liquidity, and then new massive taxes if it gets passed, I don't see how that's good for the economy or corporate profits.
No, I agree completely, Jim. It's going to be this is going to be the we're really, I think, beginning a whole new era. I call it the new invisible crash, because I think it's going to be 10 to 20 years going forward, where stock averages are just essentially going to do what they did between 1966 and 1982, which is move giant sideways in a huge, huge range. So you probably have a 50% trading range in stocks, 2 years up, 2 years down, 2 years up, 2 years down, alternating bull and bear markets. And within that market, you'll have winners and losers. Consumer discretionary is going to be hurt. Retail is going to be hurt by this process. Technology will find big headwinds. That's what happened to those sectors between 66 and 82. But energy services, oil production, coal, resources, gold, all of those natural resources did very, very well between 1966 and 82. They registered, you know, multiple 100% type gains. And so you had a very bifurcated market that came around. I agree with, I think the Fed at some point, because the stock market is so large relative to the size of the economy, they'll have no choice but to pivot and start printing money again. And the problem here is that there was no tightening cycle. This was the absent or missing tightening cycle. So they're going to tighten a little bit now. It'll probably trigger a big market reaction because this market is essentially like an addict that's hooked on cheap credit. Take away the punch bowl. I wrote an article the other day called "The Delicate Process of Punch Bowl Removal," and that's where we are. It will not go well, and they'll have to pivot. So they're going to have to come back in a couple of months and start printing money to help the equity markets, and that will actually exacerbate the inflation that's already become embedded. Add to that, like you were just saying about the regulatory issues that are overhanging energy development and basically holding back CapEx, that has to be changed, and it probably will. But the whole era of globalization, which we've been in over the last 20, 30 years, I'd say is beginning to shift. And we're entering an era of de-industrialization. So you're going to start seeing, instead of the free movement of goods around the world, I think you're going to start seeing blocks form where they hoard commodities. And supply chains, as a result, are going to get a lot shorter. They're going to have to compress in. A good example is just the outgrowth of this war that you see in Eastern Europe. Right now, you have cheap Russian oil being diverted to China, okay? So China's buying more oil from Russia. That means that China is going to be buying less oil in turn from the Middle East, and that oil, that excess, will be diverted back to Europe. Now, in order to get the oil from the Middle East to Europe, they're going to have to ship it through the Suez Canal or run all the way around Africa. Either way, it's very expensive because you can take a VLCC tanker, which has 1 million barrels of oil on it. You can actually get a VLCC tanker through the Suez Canal. The Egyptians have been very resourceful on this. What they do is they pipe out a lot of the excess oil into storage facilities on one end of the canal, and that makes the tankers shallow in the draft, so they'll float higher. And then they have to move them through the canal and put them back on the other side. They pump the oil back in. But that is more time, more money, more expense, and all of this floats into the higher cost of moving commodities around the world is going to be huge as a result of this Cold War that has now sort of restarted between the East and the West, and the huge and vast impact that we're seeing develop on supply chains, which I think are going to have to be completely rethought through. Even the impact of piracy is going to go up on supply chains as a result of food shortages that are likely to happen through Africa. So you're seeing a structural change in the global economy unfold in whopping time right before our eyes. And I think it's going to be with us for a very long time. And investing will have to change accordingly.
Yeah, I could see a long inflationary cycle, Frank, very much like what we saw in the mid-60s going all the way to the early 80s. We're in it again. Right now, we're heavily invested in copper. I see copper shortages. We also see oil heading to 150 and gold heading much, much higher. So as we close, Frank, if our listeners would like to follow your work, I know you have a newsletter that covers precious metals. How could they do so?
Jim, you're so kind, and thank you. Yes, they can just drop me an email at Frank, FrankBB, GST, Frank B. GST at AOL.com. I'm one of those old school guys still on AOL, Jim. I might be the last one out there, but I would be happy to send them an updated copy of the letter. Thank you so much.
Well, keep your flip phone, Frank, because it may go to the Smithsonian. I was going to ask you where you're eating, but since you're in your bunker, I think it's beans and tuna.
Beans and tuna. Well, I've got a grill up on the top deck there. You know, one of these days you have to come over. I still got some burgers hanging around in the fridge. We'll grab some burgers and a beer.
Okay, my friend, take care. Have yourself a great weekend.
Input costs for fertilizers this year really spike. Natural gas is the main input for nitrogen, and the cost to procure natural gas and turn it into fertilizers has just really gone through the roof.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, one of the big questions this year is, will Fed rate hikes cause a recession? We've got an inverted yield curve. What does that mean? And what will happen to the price of oil? Joining us is Owen Tracy. Owen, let's begin with inflation. There's been a lot of criticism of the Fed that they left the money supply too loose for a long time, and now they're playing catch up. And the question is, how many rate hikes will it take to stem inflation, and will they be able to do it, number one? Number two, how can they avoid a recession? Because they do not have a good track record of raising rates and avoiding recessions.
Well, I have a feeling I've been on the record, so I guess I better repeat what my record was in saying that it was one and done, that they'd raise rates once and they would have difficulty doing it again. And now they're looking like pricing in another 50 basis points in May. But the market's starting to roll over already. And back in 2018, I took a 20% pullback on the S&P 500 before the Fed stopped with quantitative tightening. And then they also started to, they basically stopped raising interest rates in early 2019. So a 20% pullback on the S&P 500 is generally what's required for the Federal Reserve to stop raising rates. Are they going to be able to get on top of inflation? I think it's unlikely that they're going to be able to calm down inflation sufficiently to really quell the problem. But if we do move into a bigger pullback, then that's going to dampen consumer sentiment. There'll be less buying. We'll start to see growth falling off. And that should then help to mitigate some of the inflationary pressures. That will allow the Fed to say, job done. It won't solve the inflationary problem. So inflation will probably ramp higher again later. But I think that what we're looking at right now is the potential for a deeper pullback on stocks. And that will then stop the Federal Reserve from raising rates aggressively.
So let's talk about one of the issues driving inflation, that is oil. If you take a look at the price of oil, lack of investment, you know, after the 2014 drop in oil prices, there's nothing, Owen, that Fed can do about the price of oil or the war in the Ukraine. So is this an issue you think they just ignore and just say, hey, there's nothing we can do about that other than kill the economy?
Well, I think that's exactly what they're going to do. Because they don't count energy in their measure of inflation. They don't count food prices either. What they primarily look at are things like used car prices. And that's been one of the biggest determinants of inflation over the last 6 to 9 months. And then rents. So property prices have been on a tear. And the mortgage rate has gone up by 50% in just the last 3 months. So that's going to have an impact on the ability of people to afford higher prices for homes. So you'd have to think that that's going to start to ease back. We've got semiconductor companies that are practically announcing investments in the orders of 10 and 20 and 30 and $40 billion every month on new production for semiconductors. And that's been the primary sort of, headwind for increasing the production of vehicles. So those are two things where inflationary pressures will start to ease back on at some point this year.
And let's talk about the consumer. Almost two-thirds of the U.S. economy is driven by consumer spending. The Wall Street Journal article on Monday talked about consumers are changing their buying habits. They're going away from name brands to maybe store brands to save money as the price of gasoline eats into their monthly budget. So it's not just gasoline. It's what's happening to food. You know, doesn't leave much discretionary spending.
Well, I think what we have is this is just another example of the fact that we are living in two different countries. Because for half the population, the price of gas is an irritant, but it's not a big deal. And for those of us lucky enough to be able to work from home, it doesn't matter at all. But then there's the other half of the economy, where people have to go to work. And for them, the price of gas means a lot. And that's going to eat into their ability to pay for everything else. So we're definitely living in a bifurcated economy where some people are doing exceptionally well and it doesn't matter what happens in terms of inflation. And the other portion of the economy might even be getting pay rises, but there's no way those rises are keeping up with the rising cost of living. And it's not even prospering. I mean, when you look at how high energy prices are all over the country, but particularly in places like California, and then the dependence of people there on state handouts is only going to increase and greatly enhance the disparities that we have between the winners and the losers from this economy.
So as you take a look at this, and once again, we're talking about the history of the Fed not being very successful. They tried to do this, and then they, with the 20% market correction you talked about, they pulled back very quickly. How long do you think, if they do that and they lay off, what does that say about their ability to control inflation? Have they lost control?
Well, I think the only way that they can control inflation in the way that we understand it, that like when we think back about Volcker and what was required to get inflation under control, it was two deep, dark recessions, and it killed demand. Now, the Fed is constantly saying that what we have isn't so much about a supply inelasticity, it's more about a surge in demand. So they want to kill off demand. And that's the only tool they have to control inflation. So we can look at oil, we can look at Ukraine, we can look at the pandemic and the supply chain issues and all the lockdowns and what that's had, the impact that that's had on producing everything. And there's nothing the Fed can do about that with monetary policy. The only thing they can affect is demand. So they have to try and tighten until they break something. And they'll continue to tighten until they break something. It just happens to be my opinion that we're a lot closer to breaking than they think they are.
So when you look at all the things that are on the horizon, and I want to move on to real estate because we're seeing it start to soften, except for at the lower end market where there's a lack of supply. But Owen, you've had prices go up 15-16% on rents. The Case-Shiller Index, you have places like Phoenix, whose home prices were up 33% last year. I had a client wanting to move from California to Phoenix. When they started to look at real estate prices, it was more expensive in Scottsdale and Phoenix than it was here in California. So how long will that continue?
Well, I think we're coming towards the end of it, that we've already seen mortgage rates rising. The vast majority of people are not in a position to pay cash for whatever new home that they're buying. And there's been a lot of movement over the last year. I moved from California to Texas almost a year ago. And I'm sure I wasn't the only person. I think there's a lot of people who have been moving. And when we think about what's going on, the pace of that movement is starting to slow down. We're starting to see also that people are being priced out of the market. So again, it's going to be about demand. There isn't going to be a big increase in supply anytime soon. There are lots of new home starts. They take time to build. The cost of building them is increasing. Lumber prices have jumped higher, and they're not going to, the price of lumber is just not going to come back down to where it was before the pandemic. And we're seeing a lot of that from commodities because it's reflecting the wider inflationary problem that we have. This isn't an 18-month issue. It's going to ebb and flow, and we're probably going to be in an inflationary environment for the next decade. So that's, I think, the primary thing. That means it's going to be, we're going to see supports for the housing market overall. But at the moment, I think people would be better off keeping their hands in their pockets until interest rates start to come back down. And that will reignite demand because housing is a hedge against inflation.
What does this tell you about the Fed's ability to control inflation, Owen? At least for much of my career, you would see the Fed funds rate go from 3% to 6%, up to 6% if they were wanting to control inflation. The economy would get into a recession, they'd bring rates down to 3%. And it was this 3% to 6% kind of cycle that you saw in the interest rates. Then Greenspan brought them down to 1. Bernanke brought them down to 0. Powell brought them down to 0. What does it tell you about their ability to maneuver? It seems like they're losing control.
Well, I think back with Greenspan, they decided that they would try and support asset prices. And they had the disinflation that came through from globalization. So they were able to do that. Now globalization looks like it's over, or it's in for an awfully big rationalization. And that means then that if the Fed is going to try and combat inflation, they cannot continue to support asset prices. They can't do both at the same time without globalization, and we don't have it anymore. Therefore, asset prices have to come down if they're going to combat inflation. And I don't think they're going to combat inflation. They're going to sound like it. They're going to talk about it. They're going to really try and convince everybody that they are going to do it. But I don't believe they're serious about it.
Yeah, because if you look at this situation that is inflationary longer term, I'm just looking at the price of oil and energy. You've seen what's happened to Europe as they tried to go green, Germany shutting down nuclear plants, gas plants, and now they may have to activate them again. So we've got rising energy, we got a tight labor market, a shortage of supply and housing. All of those things longer term get behind on what I think and agree with you will be an inflationary decade.
Well, on top of all of those other factors, you have massive unfunded liabilities. And we had national debt increase by 25% in the pandemic. And how is that going to get paid back if interest rates go up? And I think the most relevant thing, if we look at what's happened in other countries, Japan had a phenomenal boom, then they had a property crash. They did not deal with it effectively in the banking sector, and they've never been able to raise rates since. They've been at the zero bound for decades. Europe went through the credit crisis. They thought they'd be able to raise rates in 2012. They actually engaged in quantitative tightening. They took €1 trillion out of circulation, created deflation. They had to cut interest rates to zero in about 2014, and they're still there. So now the big question is this what we're seeing in the USA? Is it that we'll try to raise interest rates on this occasion, find, in fact, that it's not possible, and we'll be close to the zero bound for a really prolonged period simply because the volume of debt outstanding is so large?
What about the implications for this for asset bubbles? Because if they, let's say, one and done, and all of a sudden rates start coming back down, that increases speculation. And we've seen it in, I call it the bubble and everything. And whether you're looking at real estate, whether you're looking at stocks, or even looking at bonds.
I think that's exactly what we're going to have. I think that we're just at the beginning of the property cycle right now, because we've definitely seen a jump up in prices. And we might even see prices ease back a little as the economy starts to slow down. But we haven't seen a lot of loans getting taken out. We're nowhere near the level of leverage within the economy. If anything, we've seen that consumers have been raising their savings over the pandemic period. So bubbles don't generally end until everyone is overlevered. And we're just not at that point yet. So what I'm really looking for is a medium-term correction in the stock market. And I think as soon as we start to see bond yields coming back down, then stocks are going to bottom. And then we're going to see a rip-roaring bubbly market.
And let's talk about something else that's inflationary. In the past, I'm going back to the financial crisis, Owen, where the Fed printed a lot of money, but a lot of that money stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed. This time around, the government is actually taking money and doing helicopter drops. We saw that during the pandemic with the checks they issued. California is talking about sending checks for gas, $400 to help. Los Angeles is talking about a guaranteed income that they're going to give people. All of this stuff is putting money into the hands of individuals. At the same time, the Fed is still printing money.
Yeah, exactly that. And what that basically means is you're getting money for nothing. You know, so what do you do when you get money for nothing? You go out and you spend it. And it's going to create a bubbly activity. And it will continue. I mean, bubbles thrive on liquidity. And as long as the liquidity is flowing, then you are going to have a lot of speculation. But because we now also have inflation, the kinds of things that will do well in that bubbly environment are probably going to be more like inflation hedges. So it's going to be more commodity-led. It's probably going to be more focused on real estate than it is on unprofitable companies.
Couldn't agree more. So given what you see right now, you're short the market. You think we've got a correction coming, but as the Fed eases and comes off to that, it's back into the bubble.
Yes, exactly that. So I would consider myself hedging my other positions right now with my short.
All right. Well, listen, Owen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you at Fuller Money, how could they do so?
Well, it's easy enough. We're at Fuller Tracy Money. You'll see my name printed here. So you just type in my name into Google, you'll easily find me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the program. All the best.
We're going to have in this quarter unrest in developed countries. But I think those developing countries where you are having these multiple crises, those are the ones where I'm more concerned that you could have much more systemic protests against government over economic conditions. We've seen that kind of more recently in both Sri Lanka and Pakistan. When you look in places like Africa, there's a major drought right now that's ongoing in the Western Mediterranean. There's also a major drought that's ongoing right now in the Horn of Africa.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Welcome, everyone, to today's Big Picture. Today, we're going to discuss the possibility of $150 oil, the next energy crisis, and a decade of high inflation. These are all topics and themes that we've been discussing on Financial Sense News Hour now for about 2 years. And Jim, I want to take note of the articles that you wrote early in 2020. This is the first half in 2020. You had an End of Money series that you began in April of that year, talking about how we were going to see a wave of inflation hit. And you mentioned a big mismatch between supply and demand, the fact that the government was stimulating while restricting supply, keeping demand high, that would cause inflation also followed that up with talking about an energy shock that would be hitting U.S. shores and making a big pitch for investing in energy. So a number of different things that you had highlighted early 2020 that have definitely played out as you anticipated. And we've been reiterating our view that inflation would be remaining persistent and much higher than average for years to come, if not, as this title suggests, for up to a decade. So let's start there. What were you seeing in 2020 at that time that caused you to predict then what we see today?
You know, Chris, let's begin with energy. One of the things that we've been following very closely, and this really struck me in 2020. If you recall, we were at that period of time where actually oil prices in the futures market got negative. In other words, you had to pay people to take your oil and got down to a negative $40. And I took a look at that and it was, you know, and it goes all the way back to 2014 when you had basically Saudi Arabia, which was increasing prices. Their goal was to drive American shale producers out of business. Now that all backfired and the price of oil came down, but we had almost an 8-year bear market in prices. And what do oil companies do, or commodity producers, when the price of your product is so low that you can't even make a profit on it? You cut back on production, number one. Number two, you aren't investing in capital expenditures. And what's real key about that is if you picture a warehouse and out the front door, you sell merchandise every day to the public. Well, what's going to happen if you don't have new merchandise coming into the back door? And that's essentially your oil company. In order to replace what they've produced, they have to go out and explore, find new deposits, and replenish the oil that they've sold. So lack of investment as a result of the bear market starting in 2014 was something that we were following very closely. And this is one of the main drivers of oil prices and why they're heading higher is a lot of these companies. I don't care if you're looking at all the majors, whether it's Exxon, Chevron, Total, Royal Dutch, British Petroleum, all the big major oil producing companies, they're producing less because they've been investing less. And that was one of the things that we saw in 8 years. It was conservation of capital. And you got to remember, back in 2020, some of these oil companies lost a lot of money. And I'm talking about the big guys like Exxon, Chevron. They were all losing billions and billions of dollars. Now, what has happened since then? Well, if we add ESG and wokeism on Wall Street, they're basically divesting. They're almost painting the oil companies the way we used to look at the tobacco companies at the end of the 90s, when the attorney generals in the states went against the tobacco companies and they sued them for a settlement. It was just a way to get money out of them because they're not stopping people from smoking. So we're doing the same thing. Banks are reluctant to lend because they don't want to be perceived by wokes out there that they're supporting fossil fuels. So you began to see divestment. Then you also began to see Wall Street people get on the boards of companies like ExxonMobil is a good example. They got this one woke fund manager got 3 seats, and they're wanting our companies to divest themselves of oil projects. So at a time when oil demand is growing, we're going to hit, I think, close to 100 million barrels of consumption a day. So it hasn't receded. Actually, as the economy bounced back after the lockdowns, we're consuming more gasoline today, more energy today than we were before the pandemic. And then the other thing, too, is you got to remember, we locked down this economy for almost a year. When we came out of it, then all of a sudden people began to spend money. Their consumption patterns were changed. Instead of services, they went on buying things. I don't care if it was cars, if it was boats, whatever, motorhomes, everything changed. And what that did is created more demand for oil. Now, fast forward to where we are today, add the war in Ukraine, and Russian oil is being sent elsewhere. We're still buying some of it, but we're going to cut that out. I think it's whether it's the end of May or June, we're no longer going to buy it. And more importantly, and we've talked about this, and this goes back to the 00 decade when we used to have a gentleman on the program, Matt Simmons. He has since passed on. And he wrote a book called Twilight in the Desert. And it was really about the aging oil fields. And we're going to get into this in a minute, because basically Saudi Arabia does not have the oil reserves that are stated. They do not have the capabilities to increase their production to 12.5 million barrels. And the world is thinking, well, if we really get into a crunch, Saudi Arabia has 2.5 million barrels of excess production capability. They don't. And that's the big secret that the market hasn't woken up. So those were some of the things we were looking at in 2020. It was mainly lack of investment that almost went on for almost a decade. We're still, even today, with the prices where they are, oil companies still are not back up to where they were prior to the downturn in oil, which began in 2014. So lack of investment is right at the top of the chart. And quite honestly, the investment banks and Wall Street aren't making it any easier for these companies to invest in oil.
So again, you wrote two, I think, really key articles in the first half of 2020 talking about a coming wave of inflation because of COVID, the lockdowns, supply-demand mismatches, a lot of different things. Of course, the implementation of modern monetary theory, which is a theme that we've been discussing now for years on our show. And then you followed that up very shortly thereafter, also in the first half of 2020, talking about how we're going to see an energy crunch and that this was going to hit not just the U.S., but globally, given that oil prices had gotten so low that we were going to see the pendulum swing essentially to the upside now. And you had made a big pitch for investing in energy at that time. Given your view, I mean, clearly, this is what you were telling listeners, this is what you were telling clients at the time. How did you personally invest around this?
Well, we did that in two. Well, first of all, I've owned energy stocks for quite some time. You know, I've owned some of the big ones for several decades now. And, you know, that goes back to my family. My grandfather came from Europe and went to work for Standard Oil. So we've had oil stocks in the family going back to my grandfather.
So you have oil in your blood then?
I guess it does. Yeah. But we began buying oil stocks. In 2020, Chris, I was getting between 6 and 8% dividends on some of the majors. And when you think about it, 6 to 8%, if the stock market has returned 10% over a long period of time, and you're getting 6 to 8% returns just in dividends, you were getting almost what you would make in the stock market longer term just in dividends. Now, granted, in 2020, that didn't do much for us. We just got dividends from them. But, you know, I don't think anybody was complaining about 6 to 8% when, you know, the Fed funds rate was at zero and you got the 10-year treasury got all the way down to 0.3%. But as we got into 2021, as all this government spending and the implementation of MMT came into play, then we started to see the oil stocks move. And a lot of that was coming out of the lockdowns. Demand was beginning to increase, which was driving the price of oil. So we invested very heavily in the energy sector, which has really panned out. I mean, some of these stocks are up 80%. Some of them are up 100% during that period of time. But it was just, and the other thing that we saw too, when we got to negative prices on oil, these stocks were just battered. I mean, some of these stocks lost 50 and 60% of their value. And I saw a lot of value there. And, you know, it just wasn't us, because last year, Warren Buffett took a major position in Chevron. I think he owns like 38 million shares now. And he also owns Occidental Petroleum. So even Buffett was moving in this area, seeing the demand increasing and a lack of supply. And those are two things. You know, Buffett is normally not known for investing in commodity type investments. He likes companies, consumer franchises, the Coca-Colas, financial stocks. But even he couldn't resist the temptation of the value that represented these low prices for these oil companies.
So as we discussed in 2021, we had made a pitch for saying that we're likely to return back to $100 oil, triple digit oil, I should say. We certainly saw that. And we got to a high, this was last month, of just over $120 per barrel. We have now pulled back on the day that you and I are speaking, which is April 8th on Friday. West Texas is sitting at $96 per barrel. So we've come now under that $100 mark. A lot of this is being attributed to, well, two major things, I would say, is the large strategic petroleum reserve release by Biden, which is the largest we've ever seen in history. And then second, the lockdown of 24 million people in Shanghai, China's largest city. So those two things in combination are on the supply side and then the demand side have lowered oil prices. I know we're going to get into the SPR release later and your outlook on how this is going to impact oil prices. But tell us, why do you think at this point we should be considering $150 oil as a likely target?
Well, I already mentioned the lack of investment, which continues on to this day. And the other thing you have to look at, where the U.S. went from about 5 million barrels of production, our production had been declining steadily since 1971. And then all of a sudden, you know, under Trump, I think the last year we produced about 13 million. Most of that gain came from shale oil. And if you look at shale oil, it's a fast return. Usually you get your money back. The production peaks within 2 years, then goes into decline. So shale has been the main source of new oil the last 10 years. It wasn't coming from Saudi Arabia. It wasn't coming from OPEC. It was mainly coming from the U.S. shale. The other thing that we're going to get into here is if you take a look at Saudi Arabia, almost 50% of Saudi Arabia's oil production comes from an oil field called Garwar that was discovered 75 years ago. It's in decline. So here's another factor, and we'll get in just a moment here, why Saudi Arabia does not have the spare capacity that the world has been hanging its hat on for emergencies. It's widely believed that they can increase their production to 12.5 million. It's not going to happen. They don't have the goods to do that. The other thing, as I mentioned, ESG, it's still out there today, where you got Wall Street taking over the boards, forcing companies to divest or cancel projects. I don't care if it's Exxon, BP, or Shell. The other thing, as I mentioned, difficulty in getting financing, because there's a lot of smaller companies that if you want to run a bunch of drills, that's going to take financing to do that. And for a number of years, Chris, the shale producers had no returns for investors. They constantly were raising new capital. They didn't make any money. They were losing money. And Wall Street said, enough is enough. Show us the money. And that's what. So now you've got management discipline of capital is the rule of the day in the boardrooms. The other thing that we have going on with this administration is the administration's war on fossil fuels, whether it's from pipelines to getting drilling permits. They always throw out there, well, there's 9,000 leases out there. Well, a lease is no good unless the government grants you the permit to go ahead with drilling. And they're not granting the permits. And, you know, the one thing that Biden did his first day in office was cancel the Keystone pipeline, which is silly because he approved the Russian pipeline. And the thing about pipelines, it's easier to transport oil, especially from Canada, through a pipeline. It's riskier environmentally and more costly to put oil on a train. And so now we're hauling a lot of this oil by train. That adds about another $8 to $10 fuel costs per barrel because it's more expensive to transport goods. And here we are. We're begging. We want to get another million barrels of oil from Canada, but they're unwilling to allow the pipeline to go through. And the thing about the Keystone, Chris, we weren't even going to have to pay for it. So a Canadian company was going to pay for it. Had we not vetoed that, we'd be getting at least close to a million barrels a day of oil that would be going to our Gulf Coast refineries. So that's another factor. Then the other thing we're going to get into is OPEC can't deliver the goods. Saudi Arabia just raised the prices for oil for all their buyers. I don't care if it's Asia, the U.S., or elsewhere, because California gets a lot of its oil from Saudi Arabia rather than, you know, we have billions and billions of barrels offshore Santa Barbara. We have it inland, but they won't allow them to drill. So what we do is we import it. So Saudi Arabia is raising prices. The other thing, if you take a look at within OPEC, Iraqi oil production is down by 112,000 barrels a day. Russia has fallen short. OPEC is only producing about 28.5 million barrels. They said they were going to increase their production by 400,000. Taking a look at the statistics over the last couple of months, it's only gone up by 90,000 barrels. So it's more expensive to transport by train. We have a lack of investment. We have companies that are being forced to divest themselves. We've got this war internally against oil companies. A good example was having the oil executives on Capitol Hill blaming them for gouging, as if our oil companies controlled the price of oil. Oil is controlled in global markets, and that's what determines the price of oil. Now, finally, we're getting to a point right now as the economy is heated up, as our economy has come back from the lockdowns, our demand is increasing. So this SPR release, in my opinion, is going to backfire. So what, instead of producing a million barrels a day, what they're going to do is release a million barrels a day all the way up to the election. And then after that, that will stop. The problem, Chris, is we are going to go through a third of our strategic oil reserves strictly for politics. And more likely, we are going to have to replace that oil, that it's going to be at a much higher price. The oil that we're releasing now was bought at much, much lower prices. It's going to be replaced when the government has to replace what we're going through, because we never want to get to a point where we go through half of our strategic oil reserves. They're going to have to replace that at $100 plus, if not $150.
Jim, you know, every time we get in this type of energy crunch, it seems that presidents and other leaders will go to Saudi Arabia and OPEC to say, hey, we need you to produce more oil. But then what happens is we don't see a lot of capacity come on by OPEC. Why is that?
You know, this goes back to Matt Simmons' book, Twilight in the Desert. And when you look at the 80s, towards the end of the 80s, OPEC was basically basing each country's production based on their oil reserves. So the larger the oil reserves on OPEC production, you got to produce more. And magically, in 1989, all of a sudden, Saudi Arabia's oil reserves doubled to 266 billion barrels. There wasn't any new discoveries. There wasn't a new Gar War. And a lot of these OPEC countries basically did this. It was like a production game. Now, here's the real key thing that nobody's paying attention to. They have kept their reserves at 266 billion barrels for the last 30 years, despite pumping 3 billion barrels every year. So since 1989, the Saudis have produced 132 billion barrels of oil, and yet they're still showing their oil reserves at 266 billion barrels. It's suppose, for example, you're looking at a company that keeps selling goods, but they never replenish their inventory. What would you think if you were looking at the statistics? Wait a minute, where's this coming from? I don't see any purchases of new inventory to match what's going out the door. And that's the case with Saudi Arabia. It's widely expected that they can produce 12.5 million barrels. That has never happened in Saudi history. The EIA describes reserves as oil that can be brought online within 30 days and maintained at that level for 90 days. And it's just not happening, Chris. The best that they can do is 10 million barrels. And even to get to 10 million, they're using inventory to meet those 10 million barrel targets. So if you look at Saudi Arabia's spare capacity, it's probably no more than 500,000 barrels. So OPEC spare capacity is not what we believe. And the world hasn't woken up to that fact. And when they do, and one of the, a lot of this came out when Saudi Arabia's Aramco went public, all of a sudden people were looking at, just as you would any kind of company that goes public. You'd be looking at their financial statements. What are their assets? What is their income or revenue flows? And when you look at assets, show us the goods. Where is this 266 billion barrels? Where is this production that says you can go up to 12 and a half? It's not there, Chris. And at some point here in the next year or two, people are starting to wise up to the fact they can't deliver the goods that the world believes that they're promising.
Jim, can you tell us why green technology or renewable energy and why ESG, environmental, social, and governance policies aren't going to work?
You know, the best example I can give you, Chris, and our listeners is what's going on in Europe right now, and especially Germany. Merkel came in there. She began shutting down, especially after Fukushima, shutting down their nuclear power plants, their gas plants. They wanted to go to wind and solar. It isn't working. And take a look at what's happening to energy right now. Same thing, Chris, is happening to our own state of California. Newsom is doing to California what Merkel did to Germany. He's shut down one nuclear power plant. They're going to shut down the second power plant in 2025. That's going to be a loss of another 10% of our electricity needs. And it's the same thing. You know, we're shutting our nuclear power plants down, but yet we're buying excess nuclear power from Arizona, just as Germany has been forced to buy more Russian natural gas and even get electric power from France, which has nuclear power plants. And here's the thing that you really have to think about. Let's assume that this works out, that by 2030, all of us are driving EVs, or if you're poor and middle class, you take the bus and ride a bicycle, as Pete Buttigieg talks about. So by 2030, you have to ask yourself, where is all this electricity going to come from? Now, let's talk about nuclear power. There's 440 nuclear power plants worldwide. 55 right now are under construction, but they're mainly in China, India, Russia, and the United Arab Emirates. U.S. only has two. Since 2017, 10 nuclear power plants have been decommissioned and 20 more are set to phase out over the next few years. So we are reducing our capacity, our nuclear capacity, by almost one third. And if you take a look at how the grid system works right now, which is in disrepair, we have five or six sources of electricity that are dependable. We have oil, we have natural gas, we have hydroelectric, we have nuclear power, we have renewables. So we're going from five to seven sources of reliable electricity and moving towards one source, which is intermittent and unreliable, which is renewables. And look at, you know, just take a look at how this is working out in Europe. The other thing too, Chris, it's unrealistic to expect by in the next 10 years, the average age of a car in the U.S. is about 9 years. So you buy a car, you keep it 8 to 9 years. The EV price, the average EV price is $40,000 to $60,000. It takes 15 cents a kilowatt to charge it. So 81% of people that have EVs are charging them at home. Now, if you look at the way the grid works, usually there's less strain or electricity demand in the evening than there is during the daytime, during prime time. So what happens now if instead of your gas car in the garage, which isn't drawing any power, all of a sudden now you have an EV in the garage, and for a family that works, maybe you have two or three, and you're drawing on the electrical grid. Where's that electricity going to come from when we're shutting down our reliable sources of electricity and then we're relying on intermittent sources of electricity? So, you know, just think of the problems that we have in California. Of brownouts all the time, Chris. I mean, and you live here. How many times have we had brownouts anytime it gets super hot and people are running their air conditioners? And take a look at what happened to Texas during a severe winter storm. The other issue that nobody is talking about is the shortage of raw materials for EVs, whether it's cobalt, whether it's nickel, lithium, copper, rare earth. And when we take a look at that, China is now becoming the monopoly or the OPEC of most of these green minerals because we don't produce them here. We won't allow mines to go into production here to produce these raw materials. So we are going to be forced to buy a lot of this elsewhere. It's the same thing that we're facing today with chip shortages. One of the reasons cars are hard to get, why used car prices are this high. And, you know, at a time we want to go green, we should be fast-tracking a lot of these mining permits. Instead, we are refusing to grant these mining permits. So the other thing that we don't think about, it takes energy and raw materials to produce an EV. So where will that energy come from? Windmills and solar? I don't think that's going to work. And then if you want to talk about environmental hazards, solar batteries only last about 20 years versus a nuclear power plant that's good to 40 to 60 years. So where are we going to dispose of these solar panels and batteries? I mean, my house is solar powered, but in preparation for the coming brownouts in California, Chris, we're looking at putting Tesla batteries in the house along with a natural gas generator, because you cannot do what Newsom is doing to California by shutting down our sources of power from nuclear to natural gas and expect that we're going to be charging all these cars with renewables when you can't even, you know, good luck trying to build a solar farm or put windmills offshore California. It's never going to happen with the Greens here. So it takes a lot more land and space. According to MIT's Energy Institute, it would take 33,000 square miles of land to power the U.S. energy grid by 2050, and it would take 66,000 square miles of land to power it by wind. You just take a look. If we can't even build a pipeline, it's held up in courts for 10 years because of environmental reluctance to do anything like this, how are you going to get these big solar farms and windmills put into place? It's not going to happen. So we need to move towards renewables. I agree on that, especially ahead, because I still am a firm believer of peak oil. At some point, we're going to run out of our ability to increase production. The fact that we're relying on shale today, the fact that the world's largest oil fields are in decline. You're seeing it in Saudi Arabia with Garwar. We saw it with Mexico, with Canarel, which was the second biggest oil field. And so, you know, it's our contention by mid-decade, we are going to be heading for an energy crisis. What you're seeing in Europe is coming here unless we begin to pivot shortly. And so that's why, Chris, I just don't think, you know, we need to move in this direction. Renewables should be one additional source of electricity added to the other sources that we use, whether it's coal, oil, natural gas, hydroelectric, geothermal, those things. So it should be an additional source, not the only source, which is what our politicians are doing.
According to Marin Katusa, who we spoke with on our FS Insider podcast during the week, he believes that we are going to see all of these options being pursued, that essentially politicians are going to be forced to accept that. Let's say that those on the left that are trying to phase out fossil fuels, eventually, like we see in Europe, they're going to have to reverse a lot of their ESG policies and green mandates and say, okay, we have to accept fossil fuels as part of our energy matrix. There's just no other options. However, they're also going to overlay on top of that a very vast international system of carbon credits trading. So he made a big investment case for the carbon credit sector. Do want to encourage any of you who haven't listened to that interview, I'll have a link out to it where this interview is located on Financial Sense. But Jim, going back to the title of today's show, we're talking about $150 oil. You think that that is a target that we should expect and that we are looking at an energy crisis. As you said before, the strategic petroleum release that we saw by Biden, the largest in history, that that's essentially putting us in a bad position, because as oil prices do continue to climb as part of this long-term trend, that we're going to be in a position where we have less now in an actual emergency. So I guess with that said, let's move into a theme that we have been discussing on why you believe inflation is not something that is going to be with us just for, you know, a matter of maybe 1 or 2 years, but something that we should be expecting for the remainder of the 2020 decade.
You know, I think the big reason, Chris, is going to be government policy and MMT, modern monetary theory, which has been endorsed by both parties. Have you noticed we are running the largest budget deficits and growing our national debt at the fastest rate in history, faster than World War II? And yet you don't hear any politicians, maybe with the exception of Rand Paul, talking about the budget deficit. I mean, we were at $28 trillion last September. We're over $30 trillion now. So you take a look at spending and deficits basically now are out of control and unsustainable. And believe it or not, the Biden administration is going to try to run and resurrect its Green New Deal with more taxes and massive spending program. The program would cost anywhere from $5 to $6 trillion. So you've got massive government spending, and it's supported by both parties. They just passed a supplemental spending program for $1.5 trillion. The other factor, and you've addressed this with one of our guests, Peter Zion, and that is reverse globalization. We saw with the lockdowns and with everything coming from China, we simply couldn't get the goods, whether it was drugs or chips. So now you're seeing reverse globalization. So you're having companies, well, I don't care if it's IBM or even Intel, they're bringing their factories back to the U.S. where it's going to cost 3 to 4 times more to make things. But you have to have it in your supply chain. This was something the Japanese were very well known for. They had an aging demographic. So beginning in the 80s, Japan began to outsource its factories to places where they sold their goods. And that's what companies are going to have to do. So the supply chain globally is going to be reoriented to markets where you sell goods. And that's going to raise prices. Energy prices, as I said, are here to stay. And then a lot of these supply chain disruptions are not transitory. You just talked about one of China's largest cities. 25 million people is in lockdown. What does that mean? A lot of the goods in that city that they produce are not going to be put on boats and transferred to the rest of the world where they are consumed. And it is my belief, Chris, that you're going to see the Fed pivot here, because the only option they really have is helicopter drops and printing money. And the other thing that we're seeing is a lot of these subsidies that we've been giving to people are very popular with voters. So what you have politicians like our own state of California, they're thinking of giving people $400 checks just before the election. Well, if you keep giving money to support something, how is that price going to come down? Because you're reinforcing it. Whatever you subsidize, you get more of. And so that is happening. And as you take a look at our national debt now, it's growing at between $300 to $400 billion a month. I can remember, gosh, it was 1991 when the U.S. had a budget deficit of $450 billion. And it forced George Senior Bush to go back on his pledge of no new taxes, and he raised tax rates from 28 to 31. Clinton raised them to 39.6 in order to bring the budget down. Now, Chris, we're running $300 to $400 billion per month, not per year. And think of it this way: right now, we're at a little over $30 trillion. I think it's $30.2 trillion. And right now, the government pays on average close to 2% on its debt. So 2% of $30 trillion is almost $600 billion in interest. Think what happens as the government is rolling over its debt, whether it's T-bills, whether it's treasury notes or treasury bonds. They're going to be rolling that debt over at higher interest rates. A 1% increase on that debt will cause an additional $300 billion a year in extra interest costs. So we could go from like $500-600 billion in interest a year to quickly $1 trillion a year. Another factor we're seeing in this war, the end of the petrodollar. We're seeing a block of OPEC countries, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, moving towards a Russia Chinese bloc, of which they are going to trade in oil outside the U.S. dollar. So we're moving away from the petrodollar, something I want to discuss with our guest Mark Chandler next week, who is an expert on currencies. And then the other factor that we have here is just a shortage of commodities. So all of this, Chris, and especially with the adoption of modern monetary theory, I mean, we're spending money like, you know, a drunken sailor's right now. And, you know, this is a reflection of both parties. Remember, we were running $1 trillion deficits in a booming economy under Trump. So this just isn't a Biden thing. It's also a Republican thing as well. Both parties endorse this philosophy of just simply spend it, borrow it, and print it. And eventually we know where that leads.
So, Jim, given what we've discussed today, how are you investing currently?
I want to go back to something that Frank Barbera said, and we're going to a market, Chris, where, you know, if you take a look at the 80s, the 90s, the 00 decade, and even the last decade, you had these 10-year decade where stock prices went up almost every single year. That's not what we're going to see going forward. You're going to see, and I believe Frank is right on this, you're going to see rotating bull and bear markets. You might have a couple years of an up cycle, and then you're going to have another couple years of a down cycle. So you're going to see rotating bull and bear markets. I really believe this is the decade of a commodity super cycle. I like dividend paying stocks because bond yields are going to be kept suppressed by financial repression by the Federal Reserve. I like real estate. Believe it, as wacky as real estate prices have gotten, we still have a shortage of housing. And then if you are in individual bonds, you better not be in a bond fund because you're going to lose a lot of your money, especially due to inflation. Number one, the yields you're going to get aren't even going to come close to an inflation rate. So even though we've seen treasury yields back up to 2.6%, that's against a background of 8% inflation. So we do have bonds. If we do, they're short term. And at least I know if I buy an individual bond and I pay $10,000 for that bond, it matures in 2 years. I know in 2 years, I'm going to get that $10,000 back. And I know exactly what I'm going to get in interest. And of course, this is going to be another super decade for precious metals. I don't care if it's gold, silver, platinum, all of that is going to do well as it is now.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the income fund that you manage and some of the specific things that you own in that?
This was something, Chris, I put together about 3 years ago. And one of the reasons we did this, or I did this, is we have a lot of clients that are retired. They're relying on income. Well, if you look back over the last 3 years, we had 10-year treasury yields down to 0.3%. So you weren't getting good yields in the bond market, and then the one chance we had to get higher yields in 2020, the Fed came in and began buying corporate bonds and drove down the yields. So I looked at, I've always been a proponent, if you've been listening to the show over the last decade, of dividend paying stocks, especially dividend aristocrats. And so we began putting together a portfolio because I'd seen something I had not seen in my investment career. And that is, stock dividend yields were higher than the yields you could get on bonds. And that reflects goes back all the way to World War II. When we came out of that war, if you were in the stock market, you got a higher return on dividends than you had in bonds because stocks were considered riskier. So now, as I took a look at that market, I was thinking, how am I going to get people yields of 3%, 4%, or 5%? Because you couldn't get it in the bond market. You know, I wasn't going to go in and buy 10-year treasuries at 0.3%. It just didn't work. So we began accumulating. We looked at the drug stocks where we were getting yields from anywhere from 3% to 5%. We bought consumer staples, which are just flying, base metals, where I was getting 9% to 10%. The energy stocks, I told you, we were getting 5% to 7%. And then some of the old tech stocks, we were getting 4%, 5%, and 6% along with precious metals. So if you look at that, you know, our dividends have been going up at almost 9% a year since I started the fund. The dividend yield or the dividends have gone up over 20%. And the nice thing about it, in an age of inflation, that's exactly what you want. You want something that's going to go up that allows you to maintain your standard of living and keep even with inflation, if not do better. And so right now, Chris, you know, we're having a good year. We have actually high positive returns in a year where the markets are down. And I believe this will hold true for the balance of this decade.
Well, as we close out today's show, please remember to spread the word about Financial Sense NewsHour with your friends and family. As always, today's podcast is brought to you by Financial Sense Wealth Management, which has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. If you'd like to contact us about the income fund that we discussed today and how we are invested in that, feel free to click where it says contact us on Financial Sense, or you can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.